Welcome to our podcast. I'm Frank Long, Editorial Director of Rehab Management. Nancy Beckley of Nancy Beckley & Associates is our guest today. Nancy is going to bring us up to date on compliance issues as they relate to therapy practices. This compliance update is the longest running podcast for rehab management, and we're happy to have Nancy back with us in 2017. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Nancy, how has compliance changed or emerged over the past year or so, particularly for therapy providers?
Well, first of all, Frank, there have been a number of clarifications from the OIG, or the Office of Inspector General, as well as the Department of Justice on compliance program effectiveness and how to measure compliance program effectiveness. In other words, you demonstrate that your compliance program is working. It's not enough just to have one, put it in a box on the shelf, but they want to know what you've done and demonstrate the effectiveness. In February, the Department of Justice released a memo on how providers should be measuring their compliance program effectiveness. And it was only 2 pages in length, but packed a ton of punch in its intent. But the guide from the OIG took a little bit of a different angle. It's called the Compliance Program Effectiveness Resource Guide, and it's more of a toolkit format resulting from a joint OIG and Healthcare Compliance Association roundtable that was held in January of 2017. It includes over 500 suggestions for measurements that were assembled from the roundtable exercise. And that roundtable included over 40 compliance professionals representing all provider types, including rehab representation. In fact, I know 2 different folks from the rehab industry that participated in that roundtable. The 500 measurement ideas are identified based on what's commonly known as the 7 elements of an effective compliance program. And the 7 are, first of all, standards, policies, and procedures. The second element is compliance program administration, in short order, meaning do you have a compliance officer or a compliance committee? The third area is screening and evaluation of employees and physicians, vendors, and other agents that you may be involved with to ensure that they haven't been excluded from participation in federal health care programs. The fourth area is called communication, education, and compliance training. And the fifth area is monitoring and auditing and internal reporting. In fact, that fifth area of monitoring and auditing is probably the biggest area of compliance focus for all providers, including rehab. The sixth area is discipline for noncompliance, and the final one is called investigations and taking remedial measures. So the guide is organized according to those 7 elements. Now, given recent Office of Inspector General reports that certainly don't play rehab in a good light, as well as corporate integrity agreements that involve rehab, I see a clear signal that therapy not only continues on the radar, but continues to be a concern for both the OIG and its annual work plan, but also for investigations by the Department of Justice and various offices of the Assistant United States Attorneys across the country. In fact, I attended a healthcare summit a few weeks ago in Chicago with the U.S. Attorney speaking, and they have actually launched a healthcare task force out of that jurisdiction. And guess what? Therapy's on the radar. Fortunately, not outpatient therapy, where I do a lot of my work, but at home health and SNF. Now, demonstrating compliance program effectiveness is important for all providers in mitigating any potential opportunities for self-reporting or adverse investigation findings. So that's the first item that's new this year. Boy, and I took a mouthful to tell you that, didn't I? Another huge item has been the CMS final rule for SNFs that includes the requirements for a compliance program. Listeners may recall that this compliance program is requirement in the Affordable Care Act, rolling out with SNFs at the top of the list. While CMS missed their original date in the Affordable Care Act to give us the guidelines, it's now a matter of record, and actually for SNFs will become a condition of participation. And the CMS requirements are going to be very similar to the OIG's compliance program guidances that were released for nursing facilities in 2000 and 2008. So that's the big second thing. So once again, the Affordable Care Act did say compliance programs were required. Everybody was just waiting for the rules, even though you weren't supposed to wait for the rules to get going. The foot's dropped now for skilled nursing facilities. So those are the two big areas, Frank, for this year.
You are speaking at the APTA private practice section meeting, and your topic in the program is Heard It Through the Grapevine? Fake News and Compliance Consequences. Wow. What do you mean by the grapevine and fake news?
Well, Frank, we hear fake news in the news all the time, and when I submitted this proposal, they always want to hear about compliance. This was just a popular word at the time that I actually was afraid it might go away, but we're still hearing it. If you want an opinion, it seems, all one has to do is troll social media to select the option that meets your requirements. So you can find something to support your opinion on Facebook, on Twitter, and whatnot. Seriously, there's so much information that is bad, half-baked, inaccurate, and misleading, with the sad thing being that therapists are perpetuating mistruths and don't even know it, and other therapists are blindly following. I am focusing in my talk at the private practice section on the fake news that has substantial compliance consequences. For example, therapists never having been enrolled in Medicare are giving advice on Medicare regulations based on what they thought, they heard, or learned in school with no basis in fact or law, no references anywhere other than the fact that this is what they think. And when dealing with federal health care programs, there are so many laws. For example, the five key laws are known as the five bases of fraud and abuse and include the False Claims Act, the anti-kickback statute, which is a criminal statute, the civil monetary penalties law, the exclusion statute, and the Stark laws. And also, let's not forget about HIPAA. That's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act that many of us know to be dealing with the Notice of Privacy Practices. Within HIPAA, there's the privacy rule, the security rule, as well as the breach notification rule. Many good-intentioned folks give or sell advice that is not on the mark or is blatantly inaccurate, but cover themselves with a disclaimer that the purveyor of the information is cautioned to seek the advice of an attorney. I always wonder, why are they selling their stuff then if you're telling people to go seek the advice of an attorney? I'm always challenged with that, and that the buyer never seems to be aware or reports advice from an attorney where it is evident that the attorney's expertise was not in healthcare law. So the few people, it seems, that do get some legal advice, it may not be the pertinent legal advice because in order to get the best legal advice, all the facts have to be known with respect to federal health care programs in particular. And Frank, recently I downloaded a forms kit from a group on Facebook that purported to have anything and everything a practice would need. It certainly was an enticement to purchase other items in consulting. That's why it was offered for free. And you know, having written a fair amount of policy manuals and things over the years as a consultant, I was curious just to see what somebody was giving away for free. What I got was just absolutely shocking. A running document with outdated forms and inaccurate information, wrong information regarding HIPAA and the Notice of Privacy Practices, as well as no mention of policies and procedures needed for compliance with Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act related to civil rights and non-discrimination and policies related to language access and limited English proficiency. The forms that were there for patient intake were just simply not adequate if you take a look at really what should be included in the chart for both federal health care payers like Medicare and Medicaid. On one hand, I was horribly embarrassed for the provider that offered this kit, and on the other hand, I wanted to scream. It seems that on the Internet that many just throw caution to the wind. these are the types of instances that I'll be addressing in my, you know, PPS speech in Chicago, as well as the preponderance of inaccurate information circulating in the cash PT movement. And, you know, I applaud therapy entrepreneurs that can move within the cash-only circles. And if you're so inclined to enter the cash-only circle, my suggestion has always be that if you need Medicare, Medicaid, or TRICARE to survive and are trying to look for workarounds, it's not time to start a cash-based program. Because Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, they're federal health care programs, and particularly with Medicare, there are applicable laws for providers, even if you're not enrolled in Medicare.
Nancy, what do you predict will be the topics of audits for Medicare and other payers in 2018?
Great question. CMS has a new targeted probe and educate program that just started October 1st. They're getting ready to roll it out, and they're providing information through the Medicare administrative contractors. I've listened to webinars and teleconferences from several of the MACs. So where in the past the universe of providers might be targeted, for example, all provider probe on 97022, which is the Whirlpool probe, but that's the code that's billed by hand therapists using fluidotherapy. It's the code billed by people that are using hydrotherapy, and that could be billed by physicians or podiatrists or physical therapists. Whereas now they're going to focus on data analytics and drill down to the individual provider or facility level. So they're going to be targeting people based on their tremendous database. So for that area, I'm encouraging all Medicare providers to review the information on targeted probe and educate posted at the various MAC websites. It'll be an interesting program where they go through three rounds of reviews with providers they target for having problems in their billing documentation and coding. That being said, I think we can all anticipate that payers will be reviewing the new therapy evaluation codes for both PT and OT in 2018. While Medicare instructed all their reviewers and contractors to have a hands-off approach to the specifics of the new codes upon medical review, but in 2018, it's dealer's choice not only for CMS, and I'll include the various big payers like the Blues and the various states, Humana, United, and Aetna, just to name a few. Even though the codes are all valued the same in terms of RVU, and CMS has not differentiated payment, as well as most other providers have not differentiated payment, it still may be considered upcoding, even in the face of the same reimbursement, if you code for a moderate code, but the reviewer thinks it should have been a low-complexity code. In fact, I have a case where one of the Blues, upon chart review, and they use an outside reviewer, indicated that the provider submitted, and they actually put this in writing, a false claim because that reviewer felt that they were upcoding because the times that are proposed in the new codes didn't match the time that it took the therapist to do the evaluation. So that brings up a whole other area, and that's within the descriptors of the new therapy evaluation codes. There is a typical time listed, but it's not in a component of the code. In other words, if it says a typical time might be 20 minutes for the PT low complexity code, that's not a requirement. It cannot be reviewed saying you didn't meet 20 minutes, so you didn't meet the definition of the code. It's just a guideline. With respect to physical therapy in particular, there's been the disconnect, I think, on the part of therapists as I've been going around the country already this fall and doing presentations, and understanding how to identify the clinical presentation component, which is the most diffuse and subjective component and hard for the therapist to document. And that's of the patient's presentation either being stable, evolving, or unstable. And given that you must meet all criteria in order to bill at the highest level of the code, so in other words, if you think it's a high complexity code, but you can't meet the high complexity determination for the clinical presentation, you must choose the next level where everything is equal. So much so that I think this may be driving the overall reported use of the various codes by complexity substantially less than the predicted level that APTA predicted. APTA had predicted that we would have 25% low complexity, 50% moderate complexity, and 25% high complexity. Across the country and in some gathering of data that I've done from the various EMR vendors that have shared their substantial database, it would appear that only about 5 to 6% of the codes are showing up as being high complexity, with a split between the low complexity and the moderate complexity. So therapists are actually driving down the codes, maybe inadvertently because they're not understanding how to properly document and select for it. So we need to be attuned to this as an industry, and I call upon the industry to really reframe this so that therapists can begin providing official commentary, especially from the APTA and the AOTA, to the other payers and adjudicators out there so that we don't just buy ourselves down. I think, Frank, if the codes actually get valued differently or paid differently based on the information we have now, they might pay high codes at the level we're getting paid now and then downgrade the amount of payment for moderate and low. Just my fear, not even saying it's a prediction, it's my fear.
If you had to identify risky areas in therapy practice, what would it be and what advice would you give?
Well, I want to point out two key areas of practice risk, the first being skilled maintenance therapy. The Center for Medicare Advocacy went back to court to accuse CMS of elements of noncompliance with the GMO settlement. And that was the settlement agreement for maintenance therapy in 2013. And the court agreed with the Center for Medicare Advocacy, and CMS was ordered to re-educate its adjudicators. But based on some of my work, I think that that mythical improvement standard is still being applied when cases are reviewed. So what that means is that therapists are either not going to do therapy that's medically necessary, that's termed maintenance therapy, for fear of not getting paid, and beneficiaries won't be getting the care to which they're entitled under this hard-fought and won lawsuit. So therapists need to up their documentation skills and remember that whatever EMR program they're using can remind you when a progress report is due or when a certification is late, but it can't write your note and describe why only a physical therapist can provide the medically necessary service. The therapists themselves must do that, and it has to start with the evaluation, not on the 18th or 19th visit. My next area of risk for the coming year is related to practice, and this spans all payers, and that's adherence to standards of practice as well as payer guidelines. I will give an example of one of the online comments, going back to my fake news, where a provider opined that if they were accepting cash for a therapy visit, that the documentation requirements should be very, very, very limited beyond the evaluation, and in fact, was asking other members of this group opinion on the very least that they could get away with in their medical record documentation. And I kind of sat back and thought, my gosh, is nobody thinking about the patient? Doesn't the patient deserve a medical record that reports the facts, the findings, and the treatment? And I'm wondering if some folks just think that because they're not billing insurance, that they can forget about these things and throw their practice act to the wind. I recognize that this is the uncharted territory online, but somehow this stuff gets started on the fake news grapevine and it's replicated as the truth. And my final word on compliance, if you're a rehab agency, the condition of participation on emergency preparedness is effective November 15th. And if you're a private practice that accepts Medicare and TRICARE, be sure to be in compliance with the civil rights laws and file an assurance of compliance with HHS as required. And thanks again, Frank. I invite people to connect with me on Twitter at Nancy Beckley and on Facebook at Nancy Beckley Compliance, all one word. And of course, you can always visit me at nancybeckley.com.
Nancy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks again for joining us and looking forward to hearing from you next year.